Good afternoon, everyone. It's lovely to see you all. Chapter title for today's message. It's understanding that you are chosen will enable you to keep the faith. Oh, sorry, I just got a text here. But Josh, what are you sending me a text for, Josh? I'm in the middle of my message. What's this? Now I've got an Instagram. Oh, a caption. Oh, a photo of me. Boring. Oh, thanks very much. Who sent that one? Who's this one from? Now I've got Snapchat. Oh, that's an unflattering Snapchat. Oh, if you've got that. What? I wouldn't have put that on my story. Oh. As parents, we worry about our young people on their devices. So I'm going to turn this off so I don't get any more texts or emails. As parents, we worry about our young people with their devices, because they're on their devices on the day. They can get absorbed in their own little world. And we can feel they're wasting their time, wasting their lives. But from a young person's point of view, it's okay. I've got it under control. Besides, church can be boring. I mean, you keep saying the same thing over and over again, you know. God is great, God is wonderful, God is powerful. We've heard that, you know, and basically we sort of believe it. And God loves us, you know, that's fair enough. I mean, we're young people, we're pretty lovable. And, you know, we hear that we're saved by grace, and we've heard that, and we like that message because, you know, it's a good message. And it's one that appeals to us better than the one that if we don't do the right thing, we're going to be, you know, on the rotisserie on the barbecue down in hell somewhere. So, but sometimes, what do young people really want to know? Sometimes they'll say, well, what I really want to know is, can God do anything? We know he can do everything. We know he's all powerful. But can he do anything? I mean, does he worry and care about my situation? Does he care if I'm being bullied at school? Does he care the fact that I'm different? I'm unusual. I've got different way of thinking. And I get picked on for that. And sometimes I get really depressed about it. And then, you know, there's this sort of black space in my head. And I don't want to talk about it. And I feel ashamed. Does God care about that? You know, it's always been like that. We feel as growing up that we have a certain way of thinking and parents are trying to drive us and we can feel the separation. But parents want the best for their children. It's like it's just inbuilt in you. Whatever your children are doing, you want the best. You want to direct them in a certain way. And we've got age behind us. We've got experience. We've been around the block a few times. And hopefully we've got some wisdom. But that doesn't mean we've got it all together. And sometimes it becomes painfully obvious when we fail that we haven't got it all together. But deep down within the young person is this cry within. You know, what's it all about? What's the meaning? What's the purpose? And you know, as an adult, it still doesn't go away. And the Apostle Paul, he understood this. And he was mentoring a young minister, Timothy. And he wrote a few letters to him. And in 2 Timothy, he writes this letter. And when you read his letters, you see that he's got something that he wants to pass on. It's like he's got a duffel bag and he's got things on the table and he's got heaps of them. And the duffel bag's only this big. And he goes, what am I going to pack for this young guy? What am I going to give him? And he puts this in and he puts that in. And then in the end, he's like trying to cram stuff in because he wants this young guy to get stuff, to understand stuff. And he's just burdened with sharing the stuff that he's learned. And it says in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6, he says, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time for my departure is near. He said, I fought the good fight, I finished the race, and I've kept the faith. And he says, now there's in store for me this crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day, and not only me, but also all who have longed for his appearing. So here Paul is making a very bold statement. He's saying, right, my time's running out. He said, the clock's ticking and I haven't got much time left. I'm going to be poured out as a drink offering. And he said, but you know what? I fought the good fight. I've been in this fight and I've stayed with it. He said, the race, it was a long race, but I've finished this race and I've kept the faith. And then he says, this crown of righteousness, it's there. The verdict is there. The righteous judge, the Lord, he's made this judgment and I've got it in the bag. He's speaking with confidence. how can he be so sure? How can he know for sure that this statement is so, that this is so real? If you look over his life, Paul had a really full life. I mean, if you look back of it, he had quite an incredible journey. But he had some serious failings. If you look back, and just one example is in the book of Acts, it's chapter 7. And this is where Stephen was martyred, where he went up against the Sanhedrin. And he gives this long speech to them. And then right at the end, he just tells them how it is. And they just cannot bear this message. And it says in verse 57, as they covered their ears, they were yelling and they were screaming at the top of their voices. And they rushed down to him and they grabbed him and they dragged him out to stone him. And I don't know, sometimes we read stuff like that, but try and imagine being in a situation where this crowd just grabs somebody, drags him out screaming and stones him to death. Just try and imagine that. And it says, meanwhile, the witnesses laid their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. If we go to Acts 22, we have much later in Paul's life, we have... Here he arrives at Jerusalem and he's speaking at the temple. But the crowd's stirring up trouble and then all of a sudden it's getting bad and the Roman centurions, they don't like this sort of thing. So they come in, they're going to break this up and they're going to grab Paul and they're going to take him off and put him in prison. But Paul speaks to the head guard and he says, is there any chance I can speak to the people? And by some chance he actually is allowed to speak. And then Paul speaks in Aramaic, and when he speaks in Aramaic to the people, they all calm down and they quiet. So it's quite an interesting situation that it goes from nearly sort of this almost going to a riot to where he's speaking calmly. And so here Paul gives his testimony about his life. He starts talking about his calling and he talks about when he was on the road to Damascus and he had a mission. He was focused. He was going to get these followers of Jesus, these followers of Christ, and he was going to get them because they had to be just dealt with and gotten rid of. And so he's on this focus and he's driven, and the next thing, bang, there's this flash of light, he's blinded, he's knocked off his horse, and he's sitting there and he says, when that happened to me, I asked this question, who are you, Lord? I asked this question. And he said, and the reply I got back was, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. And Paul says, my companions saw the light, but they didn't understand the voice that was speaking to me. And then Paul asked the question. He said, well, what shall I do now? Now Paul, God had Paul's attention. Jesus had Paul's attention, and Paul's listening. So then Paul continues on. He's giving he's witnessing, he's telling about his story, what's happened to him. And he goes on, he's talking to the people, and he says, so when I returned to Jerusalem, and I was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance. He said, I saw the Lord speaking to me. Quick, he said, leave Jerusalem immediately because the people here will not accept your testimony about me. Lord, I replied, these people know that I went from one synagogue to another and to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And he said, when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there and I gave my approval and I was guarding the clothes of those who were killing me. And then the Lord said to me, go, I will send you away to the Gentiles. And so here Paul is being really honest about his shortcomings, where he came from, what was in his mindset, and where he had come to. But how do we relate? Can we relate to the Apostle Paul's story? I mean, you might sit there thinking, wow, you read his whole story and you think, this is an incredible story. And you go, my story is pretty boring. I sort of just go to work and then I come home and then I read books and then I go to work the next day. And, you know, we can sit here thinking, well, our lives are very different. How do we relate to somebody like this? But where we can relate to Paul is that Paul became a changed man. Something happened. His name, Paul changed his name from Saul to Paul, a big deal for a Jew. He changed his belief, what he believed in. He believed in that and he had to throw it away and change it. And when his belief changed, his actions changed. Paul came to understand something fundamental to human life. He came to understand that he had been chosen. He'd been chosen specifically for a specific purpose. And he was in this process of being adopted into a family, adopted into the family of God, and he had a part to play in that. And so if we look at where he started with this mindset that he had and where he finished, you see there was this incredible transformation. And how did that happen? How did this whole process of transformation happen? The question, was Paul a man of faith? You say, well, yes, he was. Well, so when did he become a man of faith? Was it sort of before? Well, I would argue that he was always a man of faith. He always believed. Because our faith underpins our life. It guides what we do. If you believe this, you will follow that track. So Paul had a belief. He believed that he was doing God's work. He believed when these followers of Christ were about that he had to get rid of them. And he believed that was right. And then he was stopped dead in his tracks, and he came to understand that he was wrong, that he was actually persecuting Jesus of Nazareth. So Paul had to give up. Paul had a concept of God. This is who God is. And Paul had to give that up. It was like this ball, you know, and he had to just get it and he just had to whack it and send it off and go, okay, I've got to start again. And it came back to saying, you know, that question, who are you, Lord? Sitting down quietly and listening, who are you? And what do you want me to do? And this thing that happened to Paul continued through his whole life, where he kept asking that question, who are you? Tell me about you. Let me get to know you. And how do I connect and engage with this? And so here is where we can relate. Here we can relate to the story of Paul, not by his very life that we have to sort of live his life, but the principle of he went through this change, he went through this process, this repentance, this where our whole mindset, the way we think, has to change. And if we understand that each and every one of us has a purpose, are meant for something, then and understand that we're adopted into a family, that we're actually being brought out of being, instead of being this orphan wandering wildlessly and living by trial and error and just hoping things work, we have to come to understand that we've been taken out of the orphanage, as an analogy, and we're becoming part of a family. And see, when a child is living in an orphanage, one of the things they have to do is learn to play the system, because it's about survival of the fittest. So they've got to learn to play the system. But when they're brought into a family, they actually have to learn, okay, now you're a part of a family. You don't actually have to play the system to get stuff. We'll actually give you stuff. We'll look after you. But there's some rules and regulations. You know, dinner's at a certain time, and you've got to be part of this family and join in. You actually got to contribute, because being part of a family means giving and contributing to the whole family. And so as we understand this more and more, that we're actually part of this journey, that God has called us for a purpose, then it's coming to the understanding that we're meant to live this life where we're meant to live and fulfil the purpose and the calling. Yeah, but I'm not convinced, you might say. Look, I've heard that. Because you know what the problem is? If I have to do this, then I've got to do what God says, and God cramps my lifestyle, you know, because I want this freedom. And I want to be able to do what I want. And the reason I can identify is because that's what I did. I understood when I was younger, in my teen years, I understood. But I didn't want God to create my lifestyle. I want to go out and, you know, do my own thing. But down the track, somewhere along the line, we come unstuck. Somewhere down the road, we have like a Road to Damascus experience. It might be a big one for somebody, or it might be a series of little ones. For me, it was more different little things happened. And one that got my attention, I was in a car accident in my teens. I may have told this story before. But I was in Canberra, I was out with some friends, and I needed a lift back to Yass, which is about a 45-minute or 40-minute drive. And the guy who gave me a lift was drunk, and I knew he was drunk because I'd seen him driving before, and I thought, anyway, I shouldn't have got in the car with him, but I did. And as an aside, young people, if you ever see that situation, the thing that's going through your head is, what do I do? Do I ring Mum? It's 2 in the morning, or do I ring Dad? Because they're not going to be happy with me. They're going to be grumpy, and I promise you, they'll be grumpy, and they'll probably give you a lecture. Give them a call. And if you're really scared, call me. I'll come and get you, honest. Because I would rather be grumpy and come and get you than visit you in hospital and go, oh, man, this is horrible. So here, I get in this car. I knew I shouldn't have got in this car. And here we are driving at high speed, low-level flying. Was just. And I remember my friend was sitting, there was two in the front, and there was four of us in the back, an old, the Tirana. And I said to my friend, I said, how fast are we going? Because he could see the speed out. He says, 105. And that was the old days when it was miles per hour, 170 kilometres an hour. We're screaming down. We come to this turn at the bottom, and the car just broadsides because of the sheer momentum. And then in the middle is a traffic island, and here's where physics takes over. As the car goes sideways, it hits the medium strip, and it starts to roll because the top's the centre of gravity of the car. And so we roll three times sideways, the nose digs in, and we flip three times end for end. The reason I know this is because there was a taxi. I was told later, the taxi parked further down at the lights and he saw this thing coming towards him. The diff and the back axles get ripped out of the car and they get thrown 150 metres down the road. I remember sitting, or being in the car and it was turning and I was praying, please stop, because I knew if we hit something, it was over. If we hit a pole or a tree, it was finished. And I remember being really scared. The car came to a stop. The driver cut all the side of his head. He was the one that was drunk. He got out, he did a runner. Girl in the front seat, she had all glass through her face. The girl on the outside, there was four of us on the back, her door had been folded flat. And she was sitting there, she was strapped in luckily. She got out of the car, she was okay. My friend, who was sitting next to her, and between the, and then there was a girl, he got thrown out of the car and the girl beside me got thrown out of the car. I didn't have a seatbelt and I stayed in the car. And to this day, I always go, somebody was looking after me. I get out of the car and I hear my friend call my name. And later on he told me, he said, that I had that was my last breath I had because he'd broken all his ribs and he was laying on his stomach and he couldn't breathe. And with his last breath he called out my name. I remember going over to him and as I'm sitting there, I'm not scared, I'm absolutely terrified because this is a life and death situation. This is where somebody that you really care about is dying in front of you. And I'm so scared. And I remember sitting there thinking, what do I do? Because I'd been told, someone's in a bad car accident, don't move them, wait for the ambulance, because if they've got a broken neck and you roll them, you could be paraplegic for the rest of their life. And so I'm just sitting there and I'm terrified thinking, and he's just gasping for air. And in the end, I thought, he's going to suffocate on me. I've got to roll him over. So I rolled him over. And later on, I found out that the doctor said, you know, I told him that that had saved his life. But I wasn't feeling like a hero because it could have turned out bad. If his neck was broken or something like that, it could have turned out bad. And so situations like this, they stick with you the rest of your life. You know, God was looking out for me. It could have turned out different. My whole life could have been different. But things will happen in your life where God will get your attention. And one day you will share that with somebody. And Hebrews 12 says, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And you know, you will hear people witness about their lives. And Andrea spoke today, very powerful witness to me, really, really, really affected me deeply. Sharing that what God's doing in their lives. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. There's stuff that is just robbing us of life. My mentality back then was, God, you're cramping my style. There's so many things I want to do. I want to go out and I want to go out and surf and I want to go out and travel. I want to do all these things. Not understanding that God said, this life you're picking is actually, you're selling yourself short. You're only going to get 0.01% of what I've got for you just in this life, and there's more to come. God has got a life for us so rich, so wonderful, so abundant that when we take this other life, we're actually selling ourselves short. That's why he says, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Things that we get so absorbed in. We get so busy about life, we actually are robbed of life. And he said, let us run with race, perseverance, the race that marked out for us. God says, I have got a journey for you that will have ups and downs and things that you won't understand, you won't comprehend. But I'm giving you life. And he says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. So Jesus is the one who's gone before us. He's pioneered it. And now as we're walking with him, he's perfecting that. So just an example of how that works. And if you remember the story of Jesus, when Jesus came out to the disciples when they're on the boat, this is after the feeding of the 5,000. The disciples get in a boat and they're going across the lake. And then later on, Jesus stayed behind. And then later on, Jesus comes out and he's walking on the water. So I don't know if you ever think about some of these things, but sometimes I think this would be quite comical. You're in your mates, you're rowing the boat and you think, am I seeing things? And you're like, is that a ghost? What is that? And you think, will I tell someone? Because I'm like, they'll think I'm on the Terps or something. And so the next thing they're like, is somebody walking on the water? Yeah, I just see it. And then you're like, it's Jesus, it's the Lord. And then Peter, they're all getting excited and like, or scared. Of, I don't know what they were thinking, but there was all this different thoughts. And then Peter sees that it's Jesus and he says, Jesus, beckon to me to come to you. And so Peter gets out of the boat and he starts walking on the water. So I'm just sitting here thinking, imagine, that'd be a story to tell, you know, you'd be with your mates. You go, I was sitting in the boat and, you know, Eastie gets out and he starts walking on the water. And it's like, wow, this is, you know, people are going to believe it. So Peter's walking on the water towards Jesus. And then all of a sudden, he looks around and there's waves splashing and there's wind. And he looks and he goes, what am I thinking? Am I out of my mind? This doesn't work. And he tells him, and he starts to sink. And then all of a sudden, he's like, Jesus, save me. And so what does it say that Jesus did? It said, well, Jesus had a big stick in his back pocket and he whopped him on the head and Peter drowned. So, no, that's what I would have done. No, it says, immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and he caught him. And he said, you have little faith. He said, why did you doubt? Like, Peter, it was working. And all of a sudden, you let your surroundings take charge and you stopped focusing on me. So Jesus is the pioneer and perfecter. He's gone before us and he's saying, get with me, get out of the boat. Come on, trust me. There's a story I heard about faith. And it was a guy, I don't know if I've told this one before, but anyway, this guy lived in America, but he went right up north. He went to visit a friend. Anyway, early one morning he got out and he went for a walk. It was a beautiful, crisp day. It was nice and sunny, but it was freezing cold. Anyway, he gets to this river and it's frozen. So he goes to cross this river, and then as he's about halfway across, not a super big river, but anyway, as he's crossing, he's the ice crack. He's like, oh, the ice is cracking. And he hasn't had a lot of experience with this. So he gets really scared and he thinks, I'm smart. I know that if you're up vertical, you'll go through the ice. But if you're flat, you're spreading your weight. So he gets down on it and he gets his fingernails and he's crawling back and he finally, perspiring, you know, it's minus whatever, but he's still perspiring because he gets to the side of the bank, crawls up the side of the bank and he's like, saved, I made it. He goes, I'm not going to do that again. While he's sitting there, just down, his heart's starting to slow down. Down, he hears this thundering noise and here comes a wagon with a team of horses and a bunch of logs on top. And it hits on this ice, crunch, crunch, crash, and there's ice and stuff, crash, and this horse, this carriage comes across the ice and up the other side. And he goes, man, that ice is pretty solid. And so the point is, his faith in the ice was really little. He really didn't trust that ice. The guy who lived there and carted logs all the time, he knew that at this time of the winter, that lake was rock solid, that river was rock solid, it wasn't going to crash. So he had incredible faith. And this guy had no faith at all, very little. But the point is, the ice was rock solid. And if we understand that whether we were like Peter and we doubted, Jesus is in a sense that ice. He's the one that's rock solid. So whether we're strong believers or weak believers, Jesus Christ is the one who is rock solid. And that's what we can hang our hat on. And so if we continue in Hebrews, following on in Hebrews 12, it says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame. And shame's something that's worth thinking about and learning and understanding. And Steve Steele gave a message a while back on shame, and it's really worth taking the time to understand how we're affected by shame. And he said, he endured the cross, scorning the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And he said, consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And we're talking about the fact that Paul was persecuting Christ, and now his whole life had changed. He was transformed to where everything that he did was to witness this message. And so we see that Christ entered our world as human, in human form. He entered as a baby, a very humble beginning, very vulnerable. Jesus learned to be obedient as a child. We see that the story where Jesus' parents, they lost him. And, horrible thing. I don't know if you ever lost your kids for a couple of minutes. Even somewhere there's lots of people and like, Where'd you go? You were here like 2 minutes ago. And all of a sudden you lost them. Your heart's racing. And then you find them. You're like, let me go. You're like, no, I'm not going to let you go. I don't want to lose you again. So they lost Jesus. Anyway, they found him in the temple. And they said, you know, we were worried about you. And he said, well, I'm in my father's house. Didn't you know that I'd be here? And anyway, his mum wasn't impressed. And she says, I'd like you to come home, please. And then it says he was obedient. He went home. And so we don't hear anything about Jesus till he's 30. So Jesus learned obedience at home. And then we see when Jesus starts his ministry, he's baptized in the Jordan. And I always wondered, why did Jesus have to be baptized? In the book of Acts 19, verse 4, Paul's talking to new converts at Ephesus, and he says, John's baptism was a baptism of repentance. And he told the people to believe in the one coming after him, that is Jesus. So Jesus lived a sinless life. Jesus lived a life that we couldn't live. Jesus' baptism was on our behalf. The Holy Spirit came down on Jesus. And he went into the desert for 40 days and he was tempted. He fasted for 40 days. He was tempted in every way and he resisted those temptations. And yet at the end of his life, he was accused of being guilty. He was an innocent man, but he was accused of being guilty. And he died the death that was meant for us. And he bore the shame that is our shame. And he's raised to sit at the right hand of God because he conquered sin and he conquered death. And he lives each day, each moment is to intercede for us. So we come back to that question, does he really, truly care about my situation? Think about Judas. Is there hope for Judas? Judas betrayed Christ. He was remorseful and then he went out and he committed suicide. And people, I've heard people say, well, that's it. He's written off. But I wonder, because Christ died for all men. Every single one of us, Christ died. And that included Judas. And it's said that Jesus prayed all night when he chose the disciples. It wasn't just he picked them and he said, oh, I had 11 good ones and I had one that didn't work. He prayed specifically. He was in communion with the Father. Judas betrayed Christ. But one day it dawned on me the fact that also Peter betrayed Christ when he denied him 3 times. And at the end of the day, I've come to trust in the fact that Jesus Christ, he's the righteous judge. He's the one that knows the answer to this. And I can leave it in his care. And so I haven't written him off. I haven't written Judas off. I thought, you know what? Christ is the final answer to that. What about the story of the woman who was caught in adultery? And what if we were living in that time and we knew this woman and all... not long after, we see that she's in another relationship. And so we go up to Jesus and we say, well, how does this work? You didn't condemn her and now she's off, she's in another relationship. How does this work? Well, Christ would say, well, bring her to me. And when he would speak to her, he would say, when everyone else was condemning you, I didn't condemn you. I actually freed you from this life. And then he would say to us, are you discipling her? Are you mentoring her? Are you being part of the process of guiding her transformation process? Or what about the story of the prodigal son? What about if, after all the festivities, you get up one morning and there's the prodigal son and he's loading his horse or he's loading the ute, whatever he's doing. He's putting all his stuff in, and he's got his nice ring, and he's got his nice coat, and he's got the last hind quarter of the fatted calf, and he's packing it up, and his brother comes out, and he goes, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Oh, I'm going back to the far country." And his brother goes, I knew you were a fake. I knew you were just coming back just to milk Dad and just get what you can and then off again. I'm going to go tell Dad." He brings Dad back and he goes, "Look, see, I told you, he's packing up. He's going back to the far country. I know, you can't trust this guy." And the father goes, "What's the deal, son? What's happened?" And the son says, "Dad, when I was in the far country, I just told things about you that weren't true." And he said, "I feel so bad about that." He said, "I'm going back and I'm going to go back and tell them how wrong I was and how unfair I was to you. And I'm going to tell them what a wonderful dad you are. I'm going to make that my mission to tell them how great you are." In Hebrews chapter 4, 14 onwards, it's talking about having faith in Christ, about Jesus Christ being our high priest. And it says, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest..." And sometimes high priest, for me, is a bit of an abstract picture. Because it's not something we see on a regular basis or connect with. And so sometimes I put in there righteous judge, just to give me a different picture, and just different titles that Jesus has. "But since we have a great high priest or a righteous judge who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess." Hang on to it. Don't let it go. "For we do not have a high priest." We do not have a righteous judge. We do not have this great God who is unable to empathize with our weakness. He's been here. He's been right through it. He knows what it's like to feel the way we feel, to feel different, to be rejected, to be hated, to be scorned. He knows what it's like to be like that. "But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he didn't sin." He didn't sin. He did what we cannot do. He says, "Then let us approach the throne of grace with confidence," "so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." And this is what Paul understood. Paul came to this understanding that God, through Jesus Christ, was putting 100% into the relationship. If we look and we see that there was nothing else that he could do, he gave 100% literally to his last drop of blood to the relationship. And then the question is, what do we do? Because sometimes we can have this thought, well, you know, does God do 50% and I do 50%, or does... Well, God's better than me, so he does 80% and I do 20%. Or we come up with this sort of maths calculation. But it doesn't work like that. When we come to the understanding that God has put 100% into the relationship, then we realise that it comes back to us putting 100% into the relationship. Now, that doesn't mean being perfect, getting it all right. It means committing 100% to the relationship. And it becomes just like when Peter got out of the boat. Because he said, you know, beckon me to call you. The minute he got out of the boat, he was committing to the relationship. He was actually engaging. He was connecting. And it was only when he started, while he was focused on Christ, he was right. But the minute he started looking around and going, what am I doing here? This is just crazy. He started to sink. When we commit 100%, then we're truly engaged and connected. And so that's where Paul came to this point in his life. That he knew, with all his failings, with everything that he'd done wrong, he knew he'd fought the good fight. He knew that he had learned to trust that Christ was the one fighting for him, and he was in this fight with Christ, but Christ was doing it, and he was the one just joining in the work that Christ had done. And he goes, "I finished the race," because he was just basically hanging on to Christ. Christ was leading it, the pioneer and perfecter. And Paul just stayed with him. And he said, "I've kept the faith." The concept that he had of God, he had to get rid of. And he kept asking that same question from right at the beginning. Who are you, Lord? And what do I do? Where do we go from here? Just guide me. Just, you know, take my hand. Show me. And that's why Paul was able to say, now there is in store for me this righteous crown. Because Jesus Christ has that righteous crown. He's the one that's done it. He's the one sitting at the right hand. And if we're part of the body, he's the head, we're part of the body, then we're connected And that prize is for us because he's done it. Which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day. And Paul's not putting any of his own things, efforts in. He's just saying, I stayed with him and he's done it for me. And he says, not only me. And this is the bit where he's trying to encourage Timothy and encourage us. Not only me, but also all who have longed for his appearing. And so when we understand that we are chosen for a reason, for a purpose, that God wants this relationship with us, this will enable us to keep the faith, but keep it in the right place, focused on Jesus Christ.